Hi, and welcome to another one of our little podcasts. Today we're going to continue going through the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and today we're going to start looking at sections 31 through 35 and really get to understand how it is we are capable of coming to know that there really is a God. And it's kind of the thing to where it's natural for us to know that there really is a divine being, that there is a creator of the universe. This is something that can, when it's properly explained and understood, I think each one of us will walk away realizing, oh yeah, it is possible to know that there is a God, just like it's very possible to know that there is this guy that's talking to you right now on the other side of this computer that you're listening, or this device that you're listening to, who has this voice that you're hearing in your ears right now. The problem with the understanding that there is a God is people want way too much proof. And by way too much proof, they're asking for something ridiculous, like knowing exactly that Jesus Christ is that God, or that I really am a good-looking individual. I mean, those are true statements on both ends, but it's something that if you really needed to boil it down into what it is, you can't prove it all in the one statement. You can prove that God exists, but to prove that God is Jesus Christ is another thing. Once again, you can prove that there is a place in the world called Paris, France, but it's another thing to actually go to Paris, France and experience exactly what that place is. So that's kind of the whole nuts and bolts situation that comes into play here. Because when we look at, like, say, St. Thomas Aquinas's five ways of proving that God exists, what he proves is the rationality that there is a divine being, or that there is a first principle creator entity out there of some sort that we all call God. And it's more or less, in that sense, defining what we understand God to be. It's like looking at a wall that has white paint on it and being able to say, that's white paint. Well, you can explain that that's white paint by defining the color as being white. But as to explaining why it's white is a totally different matter. It's like when my sister one time, we were talking, she went through physics class and she learned the whole how, from a scientific point of view, the sky looks blue and the math behind it. She tried to explain that. And I'm like, no, the reason why the sky is blue is because when I look up to it, I see, look, blue. And I just left it at that. I mean, it's the two totally different parts. One is a deeper explanation that comes with time and has other things you have to know to be able to do it, like algebra, geometry, etc., so forth, to be able to do the math equation as to why. The other is just perception, what you understand it to be, how you define it. So this is how we need to understand going in, that we can know that there is a divine being. And it's something that, as Thomas Aquinas in his five proofs in the Summa Theologica does, is he says, this is what all people everywhere call God, understanding what we define God to be. And that's really what is coming about here. So section 31 says, created in God's image and called to know and love him, the person who seeks God discovers certain ways of coming to know him. These are called proofs for the existence of God, not in the sense of proofs in the natural sciences, but rather in the sense of a converging and convincing arguments which allow us to attain certainty about the truth. These ways of approaching God from creation have a twofold point of departure, the physical world and the human world. 32. The world, starting from movement, becoming, contingency, and the world's order and beauty, one can come to a knowledge of God as the origin and end of the universe. As St. Paul says of the Gentiles, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And St. Augustine issues this challenge: question the beauty of the earth, question the beauty of the sea, question the beauty of the air dissenting and diffusing itself, question the beauty of the sky, question all these realities. All respond, see, we are beautiful. Their beauty is a profession, a confession, if you will. These beauties are subject to change. Who made them if not the most beautiful one, who is not subject to change? 33, the human person. With his openness to truth and beauty, his sense of moral goodness, his freedom and his voice of conscience, with his longings for the infinite and for happiness, man questions himself about God's existence. In all this, he discerns signs of his spiritual soul. The soul, the seed of eternity that we bear in ourselves, irreducible to merely material things, can have its origin only in God. The world and man attest that they contain within themselves neither their first principle nor their final end, but rather they participate in being itself, which alone is without origin or end. Thus, in a different way, in different ways, man can come to know that there exists a reality which is the first cause and final end of all things, a reality that everyone calls God. Man's faculties make him capable of coming to a knowledge of the existence of a personal God. But for man to be able to enter into real intimacy with him, God willed both to reveal himself to man and to give him the grace of being able to welcome this revelation in faith. The proofs of God's existence, however, can predispose one to faith and help one see that faith is not opposed to reason. So here we have five little sections of the catechism that we can look over. And starting with the first one, we find that we are created in God's image, and we are called to know and love him. So there is something about us that has an innate ability to truly perceive and know that there is a God. Now, as I stated before, St. Thomas's declaration is the one that comes to this definition about who God is. It's what, as section 34 of the Catechism reminds us in its final words, that man comes to know that there exists a reality which is the first cause and final end of all things, a reality that everyone calls God. So when we start off on this process of really understanding that we can know that God really does exist, we must understand the limitations of that knowledge. It's a limitation that's based on a simple reality and truth, that what we know about God's existence is merely something that we can define what we know to be a God. I think it's important we really get this understanding in our head before we move forward. When we really are trying to prove that there really is a God exists, we can't prove just merely by these facts alone that the God that exists is the God of the Bible or some other deity that other religions claim to have as God. There's other proofs that go into the logic of understanding the more specificness about who and what God is. It's like knowing in reality that there has to be a day in which you were born, because everybody has that day. And you almost have to rely on the testimony of other people, because you yourself cannot remember the exact moment in which you came into existence. It's one of those kind of things. There's other things that people have to tell you and to prove to you to make it possible. It's the whole, we know the 1 + 1 = 2, that there really is a God, because it's something that's self-evident to us. It's one of those first truths that we really come to. It's a moment of self-awareness. Just as you're aware of who you are, you think, therefore you exist, you can also rationalize and realize that there really is a God. And this is what's the point of 31, section 31 of the Catechism, because it tells us that the proofs of God's existence is not the same as proofs of things in natural science, to where you can put this chemical with that chemical and get this reaction, or that you can prove gravity, or that you can prove some physical law about thermodynamics, because these are things that are testable in the sense of you can put it in a laboratory and understand it that way. The proofs of God's existence are more or less proofs of more or less philosophy, metaphysics, if we were really to bottle them up into an actual term, but they're more defined ontological realities. They're stuff that we come as a proof because we really understand them. It's like if I open my eyes and I look at an object, I see that object. I don't have to be told that the object exists because by merely looking at the object, I know it's there. If I say, look at a chair, I can look at the chair and I can see that the chair is existing. I don't have to walk over, touch it, sit down on it, or anything else, because my ability to see it is all that I need to perceive that it exists. Now, can I imagine a chair in front of me? Yes, I can do that as well. But in order to imagine a chair in front of me, I have to have the concept, the mental concept that there is something called a chair in order to envision or imagine it before me in the first place. So the fact that I'm able to imagine it at all proves that in some way, in some reality, there really is this thing called a chair. Now, going a little bit further and a little bit more goofier, we could say the same thing about Smurfs or He-Man or any other type of thing that we can imagine, that on some reality, they exist. But are they rational things that can exist? Now, this is kind of the argument many people use to say that God does not exist, because we can imagine, we can make them up, more or less. But the reality of being able to make them up is we have to build the reality from something that's already pre-existent. Like the idea of unicorns is a combination of understanding that horses exist and that there are animals like deer that have horns on them. I mean, it's just that kind of ridiculousness that you have to be able to have some basis for the fact. Well, the reality of God is really understanding that God does exist because we have a multitude of evidences that prove his existence, and these are very convincing arguments. They're rational arguments. They're not leaps in the faith of imagination. And we start, as we look at section 32, looking at the world. We see how things are in motion. We see how things are becoming. We see the things of contingency and the world's order and beauty. And all of these proofs show us how we can come to a knowledge of God as the origin and goal, if you will, of all things that exist in the world. These four points of the world that we're talking about, movement, becoming, contingency, and world's order and beauty, are part of St. Augustine's five proofs of God's existence in the Summa Theologica. I won't go into a whole diatribe on that because that would take way too much time for what we're trying to accomplish today. But it's just merely knowing that we have more than one evidence, if you will, that supports the reality of God. It's not just I perceive it or I think it. It's that whole how I perceive it and I'm aware of it. It's that whole René Descartes, I think, therefore I am. It's not the fact that you're thinking that proves your existence. It's the fact that, number one, by thinking, you prove your existence because you have to think the thought for the thought to exist, and you have to be aware of the thought, being able to perceive that you're thinking, to be able to recognize that thought as a reality and as a proof of your own existence. The thought itself does not mean you exist. The fact that you're able to think and perceive that thought is how you know from thought that you exist. So it's a deductible truth, not a truth that is testable. It's kind of like doing a math problem where you know that X equals something. And at the end of the day, when you do all the things that you're supposed to do according to the laws of math, you find out that X equals 8. I mean, it's kind of that kind of thing to where you come to a resolution of the problem because you get to know certain facts. And as algebra teaches you, the only reason why you still have variables that are unknown is because they were unknown at the outset and they cannot be defined, but they still figure into the final equation of knowing that X minus Y equals whatever Z is. And you might never know that everything about Z, but you do know that Z equals the equation that you came up with. And that's kind of the whole situation here. And this is what St. Paul's trying to impress upon us in Romans chapter 1, when he talks about how the things of God are made plain because God's shown it. He's basically made his evidence available to you so that it proves his existence to you and your understanding can really wrap around it and know it. Because this is the way you're created. You have this capacity to understand this. And St. Augustine, when he issues the challenge about beauty, he asks the question, you know, you see these things that can change in beauty. You know that when you're looking at a child, that child can be beautiful in and of themselves. And over time, that child can change into an adult that is also still beautiful or can turn out to be trash. I mean, it's just the whole idea that beauty in this life is changing. But having a perception and a conception of beauty tells you that there has to be something that is undeniably beautiful that's never changed. And that something would be God. Now we go even further into section 33 about the nature of who we are. We know that we're open to truth and beauty. We have a sense of some type of moral code that's available. I mean, what's the point of a moral code if there's never going to be some resolution to the moral code? Like there's no eternal justice for whatever happens. Like if somebody punches you in the mouth and they never go to jail for it, what's the point of justice at that point? You have this longing for things that are more than you. The whole idea and the reason why we're in pursuit of things like stuff, like money or things, is because we're trying to fill an emptiness inside of us, an emptiness that can only be satisfied with God. And because of this, we also have this rational ability to question from a philosophical point of view why we exist, and that there is also further proof of God's existence. Because in all these things, we can see that there's something about us that does not have a natural universal origin to it, that does not merely come from the matter and makeup of the universe. And if it does, then it means there's a level of the universe that we're not able to perceive exactly because it's immaterial. And as 34 points out, all these things point together toward the existence of God. And it's the understanding of God as a first principle of everything and as a final principle of everything. When you think about the theory of, say, the expanding and collapsing universe, where the universe continues to collapse and expand upon itself, and you say that the universe is, in a sense, the eternal thing that continues throughout, that is what you define as being God, because God is what is first, what is last. That's really all that the definition of God is. When you go back into your mind and you consider what is the very first thing that everything is and what everything eventually will turn into, that's what you consider God. In the Buddhist sense, nirvana is nothing. And this is more or less what modern science is running to. It basically has no excuse for explaining how creation came to be because it's so far back in time we can't really know exactly. but at some point in time, something came out of nothing, and therefore that nothing is where everything's going back to. We're expanding, we'll collapse, and become nothing. I mean, that's really more or less another Buddhist explanation for the universe, but it's making the universe or the nothingness God. And this is where we really get into this concept. And as 35 points out, once we have this concept of what it is we truly understand God to be, then we really come to an understanding about how we, on a personal level, relate to God. I mean, if he's a great nothing, that's how we relate to him. We relate to the great nothing in the great nothingness of nothingness. I mean, that's what Buddhism kind of, in a sense, is. But if we really understand that there really is a divine person, an individual who created everything and is behind everything, then we know that everything that we're about is going to be judged by him in some sense, or be attributable back to him in some sense. So everything we do goes back that direction. And that's kind of the whole focus, if you will, of it, because it's one of those things that allows us to understand the knowledge of God. And when we understand him as a person, we can start relating to him as a person. It's kind of like if I knew you in real life, I could relate to you as a person. But because I'm not knowing you in real life, the only way this relationship works is if you continue to listen to more of my podcast, which hopefully you do. Hopefully you don't go, wow, this guy just rambles on and on and on and sounds like, you know, he has no idea what he's talking about. Hopefully you're getting something out of this. And it develops a personal relationship, albeit a different kind of relationship than you would have with people that you contact daily and know in your daily lives, in the sense of your husband, wife, or children, or mom, dad. But it's something to where you develop a relationship, even a remote relationship, as far away as I am from you at this moment. But it's one of those things that shows that there is something about who we can know and what we can have about God. And that lends into the understanding, as we develop that relationship, of knowing who he is, what he is, how he is, and everything else. And we can come to the full understanding of whether or not this God that we define is the God of the Bible, the God of the Quran, or the Buddhist nothingness. I mean, it's just that whole how you personally relate to God. I think it's more more fulfilling from a self standpoint of having a personal relationship with a God that you can relate to than nothingness, and that's kind of where the point of the catechism is going on, and it kind of ends this whole thought of the proofs of God's existence are things that predispose us to faith and allow us to see that faith is not opposed to reason. When you really understand the reason why you define what you understand to be God, God, you really start seeing the relationship and the reality of Christianity is built upon a logical premise. It's built upon something that everyone can confess and know is God, and relate to that in a very personal way and develop a personal relationship, because it is a reality that we all come to. So beginning with this is where we start our understanding in the pursuit of faith, because we have to understand that first, faith is based on a knowledge of God. And when we have this knowledge of God, that is when we truly become blessed.